Okay, so thanks very much for the invitation. As always, it's very nice to be here. And today I'm going to talk about work done in collaboration with Alex Azatov, Marco Gugetto, and Giovanni Villadoro. And in particular, I'll talk about axion strings and dark matter. So I'm going to start off with a quick review of QCD axion dark matter. I guess this is probably familiar to significant parts of the audience. But on the other hand, given that the computation that I'm going to go through later is kind of long and tedious and there's lots of complications, I think it's useful to sort of establish why this is an interesting computation to do at all, at least for me. After that, I'll move on to the main topic of our work, which is the dynamics of axion strings. In particular, I'll go through the quantities that we actually want to determine, then say a bit about which quantities we can determine in practice, and last, talk about the remaining uncertainties. So in some sense, this is kind of pessimistic that there are still going to be remaining uncertainties. But on the other hand, one of the things that I think is kind of useful from our work is to clearly establish what these uncertainties are, what else you have to would need to determine in order to actually come up with a sharp prediction. And that's kind of in contrast to a lot of the literature where there's been a perhaps not careful analysis of uncertainties. Then finally, I'll say a little bit about domain walls and possibilities for future work. So first of all, as always, you have to start with the standard model strong CP problem. So we're perfectly entitled to write down in our standard model Lagrangian a term that looks like this. G is the QCD field strength, eta naught is some parameter. And even though this is a total derivative, when you take it in combination with the overall phase of the quark mass matrix, it has physical effects. In particular, it leads to neutron EDMs. And these are constrained by really amazing experiments to be absolutely tiny. As a result, we know that the combination eta prime has to be absolutely tiny, less than about 10 to the minus 10. There's still some kind of interesting uncertainty on making this, getting the precise relation between these two due to hadronic physics, but it's of that sort of order of magnitude. And this is the standard model strong CP problem, explaining why this is so small. The fact that this is problematic is made sharper by the fact that the other phases in the Yukawa matrices are all of order one, and this thing also gets non-decoupling contributions from CP violating physics at arbitrarily high scales. And then finally, there's been a bit of discussion in the literature about this recently, but superficially it seems like you can't even use anthropics. At least naively, this has very little effect on physics at large distance scales once it becomes sufficiently small, once it's like smaller than 10 to the minus 2. And as a result, there's no easy way to argue that it has to be small for life. The recent attempts have been kind of linking this to the cosmological constant, and that still seems a bit dubious. As a result, these things really, in combination, beg for a dynamical explanation. And the explanation is, or the best explanation we know of, is the QCD axion. So in the simplest realization of this, you introduce a spontaneously broken global U1 symmetry, which is broken at some high scale FA, called the decay constant. And astrophysical constraints mean this has to be above, say, 10 to the 8 GeV. Because of this breaking, you get a pseudo-Goldstone boson, the axion, with an approximate shift symmetry. And if the symmetry has an anomaly with QCD, it generates a term of this form. This is at high energies. As you run down to low energies, QCD runs into strong coupling, which means the axion develops a potential. And a very nice theorem by Witten and Vaffa a long time ago showed that the energy of the potential developed is minimized in such a way that the axion automatically cancels off the bare theta prime parameter. So you get an axion potential that looks something like this, and an axion VEV that cancels off theta prime. Another really nice feature of the axion is that it automatically acts as dark matter. This is kind of in contrast to, say, supersymmetry, where you need to introduce R parity by hand. R parity, of course, also does other good things for you, but still it's a symmetry that you're putting in some sense, artificially, or you're imposing it on the theory. On the other hand, axions automatically act as dark matter, and really, you can't avoid this. They might not make up the full relic abundance, but they're definitely some component of it, if they exist. So in the early universe, the evolution of the axion field is given by an equation of this form. H is the Hubble parameter, which depends on temperature. MA is the axion mass squared. And at high temperatures, the axion has effectively no potential. QCD is perturbative, so just a flat potential. Hubble parameter is large, so the axion, if it's initially spatially homogeneous, just sits at its value. As you go to lower temperatures, the axion potential develops, and as a result, and the Hubble parameter also drops, and as a result, the axion starts oscillating around the minimum of its potential. These oscillations act exactly like cold dark matter, and as a result, you get some contribution to the dark matter abundance. Now, importantly for this talk, immediately after the global symmetry breaking, the QCD axion, or the axion field, is random over what is now the observable universe. So at the time of breaking, in small patches, the axion field will all be homogeneous, but in larger patches, which will subsequently move within our observable horizon, the axion field is random. If it starts at the top of its potential here before symmetry breaking, once the temperature drops and the symmetry breaks, it will go in some random direction, and it doesn't care which direction. Now, an important distinction is whether this U1 breaking happens before or after inflation, or to be more precise, whether it happens before inflation and is never subsequently restored or not. So if it's broken during inflation and never subsequently restored, then initially the axion field is random after the breaking, but then inflation happens, and over what is now our observable universe, the axion field was initially spatially homogeneous. As a result, the only contribution to the relic abundance was what I showed in the previous slide, the fact that it starts somewhere away from the minimum and then oscillates. And this is actually not calculable. So we don't know how far away from the minimum of the potential the axion started, only that it was some distance away, probably. So the only thing you can say is that because the axion field is periodic, at most you could put it sort of right at the top of its potential, and how close to the top of its potential you can put it is constrained by the scale of inflation, just because you generate some fluctuations during inflation. And this corresponds to giving you a lower bound on the axion decay constant if you want it to act as the dark matter. And for smaller decay constants, the axion will still solve the standard model's strong CP problem, but it just can't be all of the dark matter. Okay, the other case is that if PQ symmetry is either unbroken during inflation, or if it's broken during inflation and then subsequently restored at some point. In this case, the axion field is initially random over what is now the observable universe. So firstly, you get this misalignment contribution, which is what I described before, but also you get an extra contribution from axion strings and domain walls. This part, you have nothing to adjust, and in principle also, there's very little to adjust apart from the axion mass. And in this case, okay, this is calculable, and in general, what we're going to want to calculate is the required axion mass. And this will end up corresponding to axion decay constants smaller than in this case. So one thing which has kind of been perhaps overlooked in the literature, and I won't say much about it, is actually the boundary between these two scenarios. So what people usually say is that the boundary is depending on the scale of inflation, and if the Hubble scale is above the PQ breaking scale, then you're in one case. If it's below, then you're in the other. But actually, it's a bit more complicated than that, I think. In particular, it depends on the details of reheating after inflation. So as some sort of simple toy example, you can imagine you have some inflaton phi with a quadratic inflaton potential, which decays perturbatively into some other scalars chi, and this leads to reheating. So the decay rate is given by just some expression of this form. Now, we're going to be in the PQ breaking after inflation scenario, which is the case I'm going to study today. If any of all of these options are higher than the axion decay constant, so first of all, we have the actual Hubble scale itself. We also have the reheating temperature when radiation domination begins. So this is, well, if the coupling here is perturbative, so it's just order one-ish, rather than being like some small mass scale divided by M Planck or something, then the reheating temperature is typically significantly higher than the Hubble scale. But actually, the radiation bath gets to an even higher temperature earlier. So this is when radiation domination begins. But The temperature of the universe is actually maximized very early on when the inflaton first starts oscillating around the minimum of its potential. And you get a maximum temperature, which is, well, parametrically higher than the reheating temperature. So I think if either of these two things happen, PQ symmetry will be restored. The last case, which is maybe more interesting, but is harder to analyze, is at the first stages of reheating, you can have very efficient energy transfer from the inflaton to its decay products via some sort of parametric resonance and preheating. This is more complicated because the state you get out is a long way from a thermal distribution, so it's unclear whether this will actually restore PQ symmetry breaking. But if it does, then it corresponds to a much, much higher temperature than any of these. And again, this will push you into the regime that I'll talk about today. Another thing that perhaps is worth mentioning is that one of the reasons we really are motivated by axions or think these are likely candidates for new physics is that they very naturally come out of string theory. A kind of slightly hand-wavy argument for why this is the case is that if you have supersymmetry, then if you want to couple some field, say phi, or some function of a field phi to FF, where F is the gauge field strength, then by holomorphy, you automatically have to couple another field, effectively the imaginary part of the chiral multiplet, to FF tilde. Then in string theory, we believe at least that you have to have supersymmetry for consistency of your theory. And you also know that you haven't got any parameters that you can just adjust by hand. So all gauge couplings and things have to come about as VEVs of fields. This means that if you want to set gauge couplings by some field having a VEV, you automatically have to have this other component, which is, say, the imaginary part of the chiral multiplet coupling to FF tilde. And then this component will act as an axion. It's not guaranteed that this component has to stay light, but in principle it's there, and it's in many compactifications it does stay light and leads to axion candidates. So given that we're kind of motivated by string theory, and this is telling us about the high energy behavior of the theory, it also makes sense to check whether our cosmological scenarios are compatible with the way that we think axions are coming about. And I think that both the PQ breaking before inflation and after inflation scenarios can actually happen in string theory models. So one way that these axions can arise is as closed string modes. In this case, there never really is a U1 global symmetry in your low energy effective theory. The axion is coming about from some higher dimensional gauge symmetry, say in 10 dimensions. And this means that if you want to have inflation happening purely within a 4D effective field theory, which maybe doesn't have to happen, but if you do want it to happen, you automatically have to be in the PQ breaking before inflation scenario. On the other hand, you can also get open string axions. So in this case, it looks much more like a field theory implementation. So your 4D effective field theory actually does have something that looks like a global symmetry. But because it's coming from string theory, it's a bit safer from Planck scale corrections. So it can be a good quality global symmetry by sort of evading the usual arguments. And in this case, if you do have high scale inflation, which is again motivated by string theory, for example, this means that you're in the PQ breaking after inflation scenario. So the case that I'm going to talk about can actually arise in these sort of UV completions. Okay, so saying a bit more about this case, the reason that I think this is kind of interesting is that in principle, it's extremely predictive. There should just be a correct axion dark matter mass, which leads to the complete Rayleigh abundance. There's one parameter to adjust, and there's one thing we need to fix, which is the Rayleigh abundance, so we should be able to work it out. On the other hand, I'm going to claim that at present, the theoretical uncertainty on this parameter is enormous, so say more than two orders of magnitude. And the reason this really matters is because the current uncertainty is spanning existing experiments and also future proposed experiments. So say, for example, we could narrow down this prediction to a really small band somewhere around here. Then once ADMX2 has finished running, we'd be able to say for sure, if it saw nothing, this entire scenario is just ruled out. On the other hand, if our prediction ends up here, then if ADMX2 sees nothing, okay, we weren't expecting it in this scenario. Or if ADMX2 does see something, then we know we're not in this scenario. But on the other hand, these experiments over here could really tell you something about this scenario. And another nice thing about this is because it's linking kind of physics we can measure now to early universe cosmology. We could even say something about, say, the scale of inflation if we get an experimental discovery. Okay, so going through the cosmological history in a bit more detail, this is the temperature of the universe. As the temperature of the universe drops, first we have, say, inflation or reheating. Then we get the global symmetry breaking, so the axion field goes randomly to its vacuum manifold here. As a result, we form these string-like objects where, as you do a loop in space, you also do a loop in effectively field space. As a result, you get some string-like object which is topologically stable, and it has some characteristic thickness, which I'll call delta S. Now, these strings, although they're stable by themselves, they can interact with each other, they can form loops, and loops can shrink and collapse, and they can also annihilate with other strings. So we sort of, our expectation is that these strings will form into some scaling regime. So as the Hubble parameter gets larger, the causal horizon grows, and new strings which were previously causally disconnected move into each other's horizon. As a result, they'll kind of annihilate and have dynamics. And we expect you reach some equilibrium where the rate that strings are coming into each other's horizon is balanced by the rate that they annihilate. This regime will persist for a long time until we get all the way down to temperatures around the QCD scale, where the axion mass turns on. At this point, you form domain walls, and these end up destroying the string network.
And are these like global strings?
These are global strings, yeah. Exactly. And that's going to be very important for what follows. And the claim is, these strings are thought to release a significant proportion of the dark matter axions in this scenario. The first way that they produce these axions is during the scaling regime, in particular towards the end of the scaling regime. And at this point, we have some kind of theoretical parameterization or result for how many, really I should say parameterization for how many axions are released. So the energy density of the scaling regime we can write in this form. So chi here, or psi, sorry, is the length of strings per Hubble volume. And then mu is the string energy per unit Hubble volume. So it's kind of, this is in some sense a definition of what we mean by the string energy per unit length. But we also have some theoretical expectation for what this should be. And then the T squared is just a normalization, so that this is the energy density per physical volume. Now, in order to maintain, our expectation is that these two parameters stay roughly constant to leading order. So they will vary a bit, but they vary slowly compared to, say, a Hubble time or something like that.
Why would you expect the string tension to vary?
That will become, I'll say that in two slides. So as a result of this, you can, or if we say that these two things are slowly varying, or if at all, then the rate of energy release you can just write down. I've dropped some numerical factors that depend on, say, whether we're in radiation domination or matter domination. But parametrically, it's just chi of t mu of t over t cubed. And this is the energy release you need to effectively release in order to maintain the scaling solution, to keep the length of strings per Hubble volume constant. Now, you can also compute the number of axions released as a result of this released energy. So these are the first two things we're going to want to compute from our simulations. The last thing we need to know in order to compute how many dark matter axions are produced is the spectrum that they're emitted with. So for now, we can just parameterize this as the power spectrum as a function of momentum, some overall factor times some function, which has integral 1. And our expectation, which we'll actually check in simulations, is that this function depends only on the ratio of the axion momentum to the Hubble parameter at some time. This function could be varying as a function of time as well, but you expect it to sort of roughly depend on this ratio. As a result of this, you can just kind of write down the number of axions released per unit time in terms of these parameters and this function. So these are the things we need to determine to get out our prediction for how much axion dark matter is produced in the scaling regime. Another population of axions that get produced, or dark matter axions that get produced, are once the scaling regime ends, once the QCD axion mass turns on, and the string network gets destroyed. To compute this precisely, you need to know the full dynamics of the domain walls and the strings. But to leading order, some rough guesses that the entire energy in the string network at the time of the QCD phase transition is destroyed. So this corresponds to some energy being emitted of roughly this order, which maybe is, okay, you can't say anything precise, but you could say that it's maybe roughly of the same size as the energy released during the scaling regime. And this depends on the details of the string network and the domain wall dynamics. So today I'm not going to get as far as saying anything about this, but what our current work, where we study just the axion strings, can do is provide the initial conditions for what the string network at the time of the QCD axion mass turns on are. So if you don't have the right initial conditions, you've got no hope of computing this thing accurately. But then to actually get a full computation or full result for the axion relic abundance, you'd need to study, the spectrum of axions emitted by domain walls.
Is this associated with the production of domain walls, or is that something?
Yeah, exactly. So the domain walls appear and these things destroy the string network. Okay, so now moving on to string dynamics. So in principle, these things are hard to study analytically. For very simple cases, for example, for a perfectly circular loop, you can solve the system of equations. But more generally, I think there's not really any hope of doing the full thing analytically. So this is because you can
have a random question to ask. Is the circular loop solution stable or not?
Stable in the sense of...
Like that, if there's a perturbation...
Perfectly spherical, you mean?
No, so a circular loop. So
does it shrink?
Does it shrink in a stable way? If there's a kink, does the kink grow or shrink?
That's unknown.
Okay.
No, you do know it approximately because you know how kinks on strings behave and you know how the loops behave approximately. So I think, if I've understood your question, yes, it would be stably shrinking pretty much. It doesn't go crazy or anything.
Okay.
That means it would annihilate eventually.
Oh, no, but all these things annihilate eventually. The question is whether it does in a way that's going to be close to the circular solution or not. Anyway, whatever. This is an aside.
Okay, so yeah, maybe you may be able to get some qualitative understanding, but really for the full dynamics, I think this is going to be hard. For example, if two strings cross each other, you don't know whether they'll pass through each other or they can recombine and the topological charge gets rerouted. And for example, say you have some bend in a string, it can split off and form a small loop, which itself shrinks. So instead, what we do is do a numerical simulation. And in the end, this is only a very small part of a box, say with 8 Hubble volumes, but you have some system of strings that looks like this. So you have, say, a loop here and some string here, which maybe in the future will form this, could do this sort of thing later. And in order to do these numerical simulations, at the moment, what we do is just simulate the full complex scalar field on a lattice. There's no computational benefit to, or no significant computational benefit to simulating just the axion field, and doing so would lead to complications with, say, periodicity and things like that. So we have our complex scalar field. We evolve it forward using some finite difference method. Should we use one that is fourth order in space, second order in time, just for sort of memory reasons? If you want to do higher order in time, then you have to store more time slices. And for us, memory is actually one of the big things that limits. Is limiting.
Are you using uniform time steps?
Yes. Well, we use conformal coordinates and then uniform.
Okay, the uniform
is.
Yeah. How big is your, first of all, how big is your lattice spacing relative to the width of the string?
So we find we have to have about 1.5 lattice points within each string, otherwise it deviates, otherwise our results
and
deviate.
How big is your total lattice then relative to this width of the string?
About, so we have 1,250 lattice points
in each
direction. And going beyond that is hard. So in order to evolve this forward, we parallelize our code. Actually, we do this in a relatively simple way. So someone who really knew about computer science could probably do it a factor of like 2 or something better. But this would only correspond to a reasonably small increase in our grid size. And it would take us much, much more work. We then run our numerical simulation on this computer, which I've never seen in person, but I communicate with via a terminal and beg it to work.
Where is the computer?
This is in CISA.
Oh, okay.
So apparently it's the second largest supercomputer in Italy, and it's about a factor of 1,000 worse than the best one in the world in processing power. So even if we convinced, I think it's the Chinese government, to run the Axion code on the best version, we wouldn't really gain that much in terms of range that we can study. We then identify strings by looking at the field change going in loops around, as you do loops in lattice, around grid points, and identify things that look like they're in the core of a string. And we have some algorithm that groups the lattice points together to form string-like objects. Okay, by itself, this isn't saying why there's a large theoretical uncertainty on the result. Okay, you have to do a numerical simulation, but people do numerical simulations of QCD, and they get out very nice, precise lattice results. So what is the problem here? And really, the hard thing is that we have a big separation of scale. On one hand, our string core is very thin. It's parametrically 1 over the decay constant. But we also have the Hubble scale, which is much, much larger. And we care about the Hubble scale at the time of the QCD phase transition. So this is like M Planck divided by lambda QCD squared, which is enormous compared to this. And things get even worse because, at least to leading approximation, the properties of the strings depend on the separation between these two scales. So because it's a global string, most of its energy is stored not in the string core, but in the field a long way away from the core. So this leads to a logarithmic divergence in the energy per unit length, which is mu. And this divergence is cut off by the Hubble scale, which is the distance between strings.
Okay, yeah, but that's if there is one string per Hubble volume.
Yes, indeed. So this is to leading order. It's not a sharp prediction. There should be some order one coefficient here, probably.
Well, no, but if the number of strings is per Hubble volume is changing with time, changing that, which is an extra.
Yeah, sure. Again, I think it will only be a factor in here, which is like somewhere between, say, 1/10 and 10. I wouldn't expect.
Unless you have many strings, why should that matter too much?
Oh, no, but like if the number of strings is going up with log, say, then the distance between them.
Then it's not a big.
We're going from, say, we go from like a string length per Hubble of 1 to 10, so it's not going to really be an enormous factor here.
Yeah, no, log is nothing.
And then the physical scale separation, which is what we want to study, corresponds to this alpha, which is the scale separation and will appear in lots of my plots of order like 10 to the 30. But even though you have a log, this log still reduces this down only as far as 70. So you've got like, really you want to study a separation between these two things that's absolutely enormous. On the other hand, when we're doing our numerical simulation, on one hand, we have to have a few lattice points per string core. So this is roughly, say, a string core here. We want it to include some lattice points. But we also, and this needs to be simulated, well, firstly, because you can check that the dynamics change if you don't have this satisfied. But also, theoretically, you kind of expect that if strings are crossing each other, whether or not they pass through each other will depend. Well, in order to see that accurately, you need to resolve the string core. But you also need to include a few Hubble patches in your simulation because this is the typical length scale over which strings can interact. This is in contrast to, say, lattice QCD, where you certainly don't need to simulate a whole of a Hubble patch in order to calculate the mass of a proton, which is fortunate. So even doing our best with the simulations, we're constrained to this log alpha, or log of the scale separation, being somewhere in the region of 6 compared to the physical parameter, which is like 70. One of the deficiencies of the current literature is they just quote results at small scale separations. On the other hand, we want to do slightly better and at least study how properties of the string network vary as you change alpha.
Sorry, what do you mean by that small scale separation?
Just the separation between the size of the string core and the Hubble parameter. So
I have a naive question. So it sounds like you're using this lattice simulation to resolve the detailed dynamics of the string very precisely and nicely, but then of course your simulation volume is whatever, 1,000 times too small, whatever it is. So
many, many more than 1,000.
Exactly. So is there any chance of using this kind of small volume within which you can do control things precisely to sort of build up, I guess, the equivalent of a hadronization model?
Yes, this is exactly what we'd like to do. In practice, I don't know how you'd actually do it, though.
Right, so sort of parameterize interactions in some way, crossings in some way, and then you just put that on some string model that's not lattice, but just some...
This is very tempting. In terms of actually going beyond the sort of idea to doing it in practice, I think there's some step that needs to be done, but certainly it's something we'd like to think about.
Because there's no no-show, like going, if you know sort of string interactions on these small scales, the very fact that the string length is so small means that lessons you learn in your small box should sort of scale to the big box in a way, right?
Like, yeah,
it shouldn't
exactly
depend on things that are very
broad. Yeah, definitely. So in 2D, I think this is doable kind of on a short time scale, because there your strings are just point charges, so the range of things that you have to parameterize for the dynamics is pretty small. You just have to things. In 3D, it's a bit more complicated because you have to worry about, say, things chastening out, kinks forming, whether things are stable under small perturbations away, these sort of questions. But yeah, it's certainly something that might tell you something interesting. So one thing we can do to slightly help the situation is to make it so that change our Lagrangian so that the string core size changes with time. So I should emphasize this changes the equation of motion, and as a result, it could change the string dynamics. So because of this, we use this trick, but we also check our results against the case where you don't use it. So in particular, if we make this coupling here in our Lagrangian time dependent, so that it decreases with time, the size of the string core increases with time. This doesn't actually change the maximum scale separation that we can study. You're still constrained just by this simple picture that I showed before of like string cores and Hubble boxes to have your log less than 6. But by doing this, it makes it so that you can run your simulation for a lot longer before you reach the maximum scale separation. So for example, in order to go from scale separations of 10 to 1,000, it now takes a factor of time of 10 to the 4 rather than 10 to the 2. This has some benefits. It means that if we start from different initial conditions, we have longer to converge to, say, the scaling solution and lose the information or check that we're independent of the initial conditions. It also means you have more redshifting of the energy in your system. So any sort of initial energy you get from your initial conditions has disappeared more effectively, and you can get the spectrum more precisely. And also at early times, it means there's a bigger separation between the Hubble scale and the size of the string core, which again helps to calculate the spectrum. But really, I stress, we look at results with and without doing this trick, and they agree to, or the qualitative dynamics are the same in both cases. So the first thing we want to compute is the string length per Hubble volume. So this is a plot of chi, which is the string length per Hubble volume, as I defined before, against the value of the log, so effectively the size of the string divided by the Hubble parameter, log of alpha. And this is going up to, say, log of alpha being 6, which is the most we can do. And on a log plot, this looks pretty straight to me. So our belief is that, indeed, this is showing us that the string length per Hubble volume increases as the scale separation increases logarithmically. This is theoretically motivated because the energy of the string is going up, so the string tension is going up. So you could imagine that it becomes harder for strings to annihilate. They last longer before they get destroyed. And I'm certainly not claiming that the extrapolation is definitely valid all the way to the QCD scale, but if it is, this means that our string length per Hubble volume, and consequently the energy released into dark matter axions, will grow by a factor of 10 between these small scale separations and the physical value, which is all the way over there somewhere. Of course, this by itself isn't enough to convince us that we're actually seeing a log increase even over this range of scale separations. So what you want to do is start with a whole range of different initial conditions, start with systems that are overdense with more strings than you think, or underdense with fewer strings, or with random initial conditions, so just the field being random rather than being in the form of strings, and see what happens. So here I've plotted the string length divided by the log. So if we are seeing a log increase, then this should go to a constant. And we're starting with really quite a wide range of extremes for the initial properties of the simulation. And it looks at least to us that no matter where you start, given some reasonable length of time, this goes towards being a constant, which corresponds to going towards a log increase, just because of the way I've normalized the axis. And also, it seems like the final result is independent of the details of the phase transition. And it also seems independent of the details of the UV model. So if you change, say, the couplings in your Lagrangian by whatever you like, really, these plots don't change it substantially, which is really sort of what you expect to some extent, that the details of the very small-scale dynamics don't change the overall properties of the network too dramatically. Indeed, that's a good thing if we want to get a prediction out. That all those plots were done using the fat string trick, but we also want to check things without doing this. So in this case, you have much less time. You have the same scale separation, but this corresponds to very little time.
What changes as you go up?
For these initial conditions.
Okay.
These are just initial conditions. So for these, we wrote an algorithm that creates a fixed number of strings in a box. But we also did initial conditions where you just have random fields, things like that.
Is this a total length of all string, including loops?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And is there a problem with sort of loops disappearing because they become smaller than you?
You can only have loops down to some size. I think the next slide, perhaps I show this in more detail. So this, in the non-fat case, has slightly different parameters by, like, say, 10 or 20% for the gradient here, although that's maybe even within errors. But the overall physics seems pretty similar. So this is the distribution of loop lengths within our simulation as time progresses. So in particular, I've plotted the cumulative string length in loops with some size less than L against L, normalized to the Hubble parameter at some time. This is for early times and then moving to later times. So first thing is there's this cutoff here, which is due to not being able to have loops smaller than this size, just due to the lattice spacing. So you can't fit in any loops with length less than this, just you don't have enough lattice points. And then up here on the latest times, you can see that we don't have enough Hubble volumes to make a lattice or make a loop with length bigger than this. Now, as time progresses, it seems like this is also the line with gradient one. So it seems we're reaching some sort of solution where the number of loops in a log interval is constant, which maybe is theoretically expected or is theoretically reasonable. So you have loops that shrink over time, and then it deviates slightly, but looks pretty consistent. Of course, I've just presented plots, but actually there's a lot of things that you have to check in the background. So one very simple thing is you want to check that your results are independent of the number of Hubble patches in your simulation, or you stop your simulations early enough. And to do this, this one you can check quite easily. You just run the same initial field configuration in boxes of different sizes and then see when they deviate from each other. So this is corresponding, for example, to a solution with a small box, and it starts deviating from a bigger simulation when you get down to, say, 2 Hubble lengths per volume. And then this means that for our full simulation, we should cut it off when we get to 2 Hubble volumes, or 2 Hubble lengths, sorry. One slight aside is that in 2D you can say more about strings. So in this case you can dualize the system, effectively define a dual electromagnetic field, and then the dynamics of the strings are identical to those of point charges in two dimensions. So in particular they have some potential that is logarithmic, and they also have an effective mass which in this case really is logarithmic as well. So here you have slightly stronger arguments for why the string number density should go up as log based on how long charges take to annihilate. And if you do a simulation, you see that we again get this log increase out. This is now the number of strings per Hubble area. Okay. The other thing you need to compute is the energy emitted by the strings. So you can get, based on your sort of expectation that mu should go as log of the scale separation, and your measurement of the string length per Hubble volume, a prediction for, or some theoretical expectation for how much energy should be emitted as a function of time in some units. And then you can also compare this with the energy you measure in your simulation in axions and in radial modes. And we find that this is kind of non-trivial because you have to mask out the strings in order to compute the energy in axions rather than including any energy in the strings. But you can do this and you can check that you're not getting any numerical artifacts.
The theoretical expectation is that power, which you had like rho in strings over T, that's the theoretical expectation?
Yeah, exactly. So you get this from the string tension of, say, having some order one coefficient here, which I think goes from like a quarter here to, say, a say four here. And then you combine this with your measurement of chi of T, and you just compute directly how much energy has to be emitted to maintain the scaling solution. One slightly strange thing that perhaps is connected to some of the dynamics I'll show soon is that a significant proportion of the energy is going into radial modes. So even though these things are heavy, they're still getting, say, of order 10 or 15% of the energy, which is strange. The proportion goes down very slightly, but not very fast. Okay, then the other thing, or the other important quantity for the axion relic abundance is the spectrum of axions emitted. So here there are two theoretical expectations. You could either have a power law that, well, if you have the spectrum as a function of momentum, this is your Hubble scale, this is the string core size, or inverse string core size. You could either have a soft spectrum, which falls off as 1 over k to the sum high power, so that the axion momentum is peaked around here. Or you could have a 1 over k dependence, in which case the average axion momentum is, well, larger by a factor of log, or the inverse momentum is smaller by a factor of log. This one is reasonable based on the claim, or based on sort of the claim that global strings become closer to local strings as you increase the string tension. This one has been argued by Sakivi, and it's not quite clear what his argument is, but it's a possibility. And this has an impact on the relic abundance. So this is the effect of suppression of the number of axions produced as a function of M, where M is the power law of your spectrum. So, and this is all compared to taking M to infinity, in which case the axion momentum is always at the Hubble parameter.
Sorry, I'm confused about that one. So if the axions are produced slow, I would imagine that you have many more left over at the end. If the spectrum is very hard, you would get more axion radiation. Because, I mean, in the end, most of the axions produced come at the last, basically, at Hubble, yeah. when the axion starts oscillating.
Yeah.
So why at m equals 2 I get less axion relic density? This is...
This is effectively 1 over what... This is the suppression factor. So as you make m larger, you get more relic abundance.
You get more energy.
You multiply by this number.
Yeah, multiply by this number to...
Okay. I got confused, sorry.
Down here you have
you
1 over log.
Suppression.
So between these two theoretical expectations, there's a kind of claim that at large values of the log, these global strings should have the same dynamics as local strings. And this should be up to corrections of 1 over the log. For circular loops, you can make this precise and really have an analytic solution of the number go to a string. In this case, you see that a loop bounces many times, and then some sort of energy argument tells you that most of the momentum should be emitted at around the Hubble scale, corresponding to a very strong power law, or very axion spectrum, which is very strongly peaked around the Hubble scale. And then the alternative promoted by Sakivian people is that, say, collapsing loops are overdamped and don't bounce much, which perhaps leads to M being 1. Okay, so for the collapsing loops, you can study this in your simulation. So first of all, we create some ensemble of non-circular loops. You can also do it for circular loops, but non-circular is kind of interesting because you want to see how making small perturbations away from circular changes things. And then you study the spectrum emitted after the loops have all collapsed. So this is what we get out. So we find you shouldn't take this, the exact numbers here too precisely, but roughly this corresponds to the initial string loop size or string loop radius. in some sense, because they're non-circular. And then this is the string core size here, inverse string core size. So we find the gradient falls off as a power stronger than 1, which is reasonable based on the dynamics of, the dynamics I showed on the last slide. A significant proportion of energy is being emitted at the string core effective frequency, which perhaps is a sign that we haven't got large enough scale separation to really decouple the heavy modes from the light dynamics. Another thing you can do is look at the collapse time or the evolution of a collapsing loop as time progresses. So this is for perfectly circular loops. So we start off with some initial radius and we study how loops collapse as a function of time for different initial radiuses. And this is starting with, as we go from this one to this one to this one, it corresponds to larger initial radiuses corresponding to larger logs. And then this blue dotted one is the prediction for a local string. So we see that as we go to larger scale separations, we move towards the cosine prediction, which is giving us some confidence that the dynamics, things are working the way we expect them to, that you get closer towards local strings. Okay, the next thing you want to do is compute your spectrum from the complete string network. So the easiest or one way you can do this is by looking at the energy emitted in some small time interval. So you look at the energy in your simulation and then look at it some small time later and compare the difference to what you'd expect if there was no emission. And this is the result we get out. So this is the instantaneous power emitted as a function of momentum. And we find that it is peaked somewhere a little bit above Hubble and then falls off with a gradient which is shallower than 1. So when we saw this, we were very confused, and to be honest, we still are. But we've checked everything, cross-checked as much as we can, and this really seems to be what the simulation is telling us. One thing you might think is that we're still getting a significant amount of energy being emitted at around the string core. So perhaps this is a sign that we haven't got to large enough scale separations to decouple the heavy modes. And this could be making the gradient shallower than would actually happen in the physical regime. So we believe that this is true for the regime we can study, but it may well not be true for the physically relevant. It probably isn't true for the physically relevant regime at much, much larger scale separations. That was the instantaneous energy emitted, but you can also look at the total energy in your simulation. So this is the total power as a function of momentum for different times, going from, say, log alpha is 4.5 up to 6. And these are the results we get out. So actually, the gradient here isn't so useful to tell you the power spectrum. That's because you get redshifting of energy at earlier times. So this gradient always ends up being, 1 over k-ish here, regardless of what the actual power spectrum is. And it's the actual instantaneous power spectrum that matters for the relic abundance. On the other hand, it's useful as a cross-check. So if you put in your prediction of, or your measurement of the string length per Hubble volume and your instantaneous emission spectrum, you can calculate how much power you should see in your simulation at each time. So here I've plotted in dashed lines our prediction, and then in solid lines our measured power. And this is taking this form of the instantaneous emission, which has this soft emission, which is like minus 0.8 or whatever.
Sorry. So the kink is again at the mass of the radial modes?
Yep, exactly. And we see there's pretty good agreement between the prediction and the measured value. So this gives us confidence that this actually is the instantaneous power being emitted. On the other hand, you can try to do the same thing, but put in a fake emission spectrum, or an emission spectrum not equal to what you measure, but with, say, m equals 1, which is what people would argue for theoretically. And you see there really is bad agreement between the prediction and the measured value. So, and this is really the best we can do by changing the shape of the instantaneous emission spectrum while keeping m equal 1. This is the best we can manage. So I think this case is really strongly disfavored for the regime we can simulate. Another consistency check you can do is look at the number density of axions produced. This is very similar to the power, but has an extra, effectively, 1 over k dependence in the integral, which means that it's a bit more IR dominated than the total power of the system. And then again, you can compare, say, some prediction based on the measured chi of t with the actual number density measured directly in the simulation, which is the solid line. And again, we see good agreement for the power spectrum that we measure from the instantaneous difference
this
between.
This is the number density per t. This is the y. What is the.
Yeah, there should be a t cubed and some normalization factors here. Yeah. So actually, we also check the overall normalization of these things, but there's some factors here. So I think really this is all consistent with a UV dominated power spectrum, or more UV dominated power spectrum than we expect in the physical regime. Then another step, which we haven't done yet, but needs doing in the future, is to look at the effect of domain walls. So when the QCD axial mass turns on, you get effectively your vacuum manifold changes from this to this, so the axial mass happens. It becomes periodic. You don't know how many minimum there are. That's a model-dependent question. And in particular, this has important effect on the dynamics of domain walls. So if the anomaly coefficient is 1, then the domain walls are automatically unstable and they just decay away automatically. Whereas if the anomaly coefficient is larger than 1, then the domain walls are naively stable in the absence of extra PQ symmetry breaking, which is clearly bad for observations. So if you want to make your model work, you have to add in extra PQ breaking by hand. This is dangerous because then you might violate the existing bounds and say the neutron EDMs. And if you trusted current simulations, it would seem that this scenario is mildly ruled out, or at least in some tension without fine tuning. On the other hand, I don't think you should trust the current simulations, so this scenario perhaps could still be viable. Then there's extra things which haven't actually been considered properly in the literature. So for example, the axial mass first becomes cosmologically relevant when it becomes equal to the Hubble parameter. But subsequently, the axial mass as a function of temperature has a strong power law. So it's going to continue increasing fast and quickly become much larger than the Hubble parameter. On the other hand, the typical size of the domain walls is going to be roughly an inverse Hubble length up to, say, order one factors. This means the momentum of the lowest harmonics is of order the Hubble parameter, and emission at higher harmonics is strongly suppressed. Then there are kind of natural questions which haven't been answered about whether this mismatch or this increase in the axial mass makes it harder for the domain walls to shrink and annihilate away. And this, in principle, could have a large effect on the relic abundance. So perhaps the summary of what we've done so far for the string network, looking at its impact on the relic abundance produced in the scaling regime. We have a measurement of chi, which seems to increase logarithmically. There's no guarantee that this will continue all the way up to the physical scale separation, but at least it's plausible. On the other hand, we unfortunately can't reliably determine the power spectrum from our simulations at present. So going through the calculation, you find that I'm putting these ingredients in. You see that the number of axions produced by the string network in scaling compared to the number of axions produced in misalignment has an expression of this form, so some factor that's almost 1 chi when the temperature drops to the QCD scale, which, if this extrapolation is valid, will be up to 10. And then this function depending on the power law. So this could vary between 1 and 70. And so this, when you put these things together, it means that, well, if everything went in the right direction, you could be producing almost a factor of 1,000 more axions from strings compared to misalignment. Whereas if, say, at log of 10, this thing flattens off, and if it happened that m was about 1, which I suspect it probably isn't, but it might be, then these two things would be comparable. And this translates into a prediction for the axion dark matter mass, or equivalently the required decay constant, which could vary between, say, here and here. This is assuming an instanton prediction for the temperature dependence.
So this is the power alpha, because you're using the same...
Yeah, this is an unfortunate notation, I'm afraid, sorry. So alpha here is alpha prime. This is the power
law. So this is the power law in the exponent, T over T naught.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas this is perhaps the most different that the power law could be based on the most extreme lattice.
So from the way you've drawn it, it looks like always, even in the most optimistic case, it looks like strings dominate the energy spectrum.
So this M equals one is assuming that...
Relative to the misalignment, exactly. So is that, can you say that conclusively, that most of the axioms will come from strings?
So this is assuming that this extrapolation is valid. If something, if chi saturates and it stops increasing at, say, log of 10, you'd be somewhere up here and the two would be pretty comparable.
Yeah. Oh, you mean chi, the susceptibility?
No, so chi, xi.
Xi.
That's
this is xi.
Sorry. I should have got my Greek letters correct.
I
this is
like xi. But so,
xi.
Okay, this is something I definitely check. Apologies. Okay. And that, so,
and then the domain walls would increase it even more.
Yeah. So this isn't including domain walls. And given what I said, a couple of slides ago about not knowing it, it could be much more if they take a long time to destroy the network.
So it could be that it's actually already pulled out.
Yes, indeed. If everything goes in that direction. So of course, this situation is not ideal. You'd like to improve things further. So running your existing simulations on bigger computers for longer leads to relatively little gain. So one reason for this is the processing power you need goes as the fourth power of the number of grid points. And also you get increasing memory requirements. And also you want to study things in terms of log of the scale separation. So you lose exponentially. A very tempting thing to do, as I said earlier, is some sort of effective field theory approach where you parameterize the degrees of freedom of the strings and treat these as the fundamental objects in your simulation. This may be possible, but I think some thought and care is needed to avoid tricking yourself or avoid missing physically relevant effects. One thing which I think Rob suggested first is you do something with an adaptive mesh, so you have finer mesh spacing in regions where you needed it, which is around the string cores. So for example, say you have strings here, here, and here, you'd have a fine mesh here, and then very diffuse mesh in other regions. The reason that this might actually work is that most of the axions have momentum around the Hubble scale. So away from the strings, you don't need to resolve any finer than, say, Hubble scale.
Would that affect, though, your determination of the K power?
You'd need to be careful, yeah. So you'd need enough lattice spacing away from the strings that you could see the power law, especially given this thing of it being UV dominated. That's a concern. And also in practice, implementing this is possible, but it's proper computer programming in the sense that...
Above your pay grade.
you have to do... I think we've done a decent job for physicists doing computer programming, but if you want to do this really carefully and get a big gain, which is what you need in order to really change the range of alpha, log alpha that you're studying, you need to do it properly.
It's a factor of 10 is in alpha.
No, you'd definitely not win 10 in log alpha, sadly. You'd perhaps win 10 in the linear grid sizing, which would correspond to, say, 2 or 3 in log alpha. Perhaps if you're optimistic, this might be enough for the power law to start see a change in the power law, even if it doesn't go to like being bigger than the power being bigger than 1. You might see it going from being like 0.8 to being 1, which would give you a hint at least. But there's no guarantee that after all of this work, you would really see something dramatically different. Okay, so I will skip the previous literature, but suffice to say, I don't think it's very trustworthy. If you're interested, I can discuss in detail why that is the case. And instead, I'll just conclude and say that I think if PQ symmetry is broken after inflation, there is in principle a unique axion dark matter mass prediction. We've checked, and it seems that this doesn't depend on the details of the UV model, so there should just be a right answer. This is experimentally important. It's also related to early universe cosmology. Unfortunately, the exact calculation is challenging. You can't study the physically relevant regime. We find that the string density does increase in the regime we can study. Emitted spectrum doesn't match our expectations. And in principle, these things can lead to more than an order of magnitude change in the required axion dark matter mass. And even if we can't get precise answers, actually, I think it's worthwhile to be careful about what the uncertainties are and the things that, to avoid tricking yourself, for example, just by taking the result directly from a simulation, a small-scale separation, and saying that this is the answer. OK, so thank you.
Questions?
Yeah. So, apologies if you said it while I was out of the room, but one thing that, you know, within the cosmic string community, there was a sort of, as I understood it, there at one point, there was a little bit of a disagreement between Mark Hindmarsh's group and others who were looking at simulations of global strings, which is, you know, what these seem to be, where there was, Mark Hindmarsh was claiming that they weren't at all like Nambu-Goto strings. So do you, I'm not quite clear that, I mean, here, because your core size is pretty small, it's not clear that you're perhaps definitively killing Mark's results, but do you have any commentary on that?
So I guess one thing you can say is that when you look at the individual loops, they seem to be getting closer towards the local string prediction. The power law, and another thing you could look at is say whether the strings bounce. I haven't plotted it, but you expect that the local string bounces many times, and you see that they do indeed bounce more often.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mark saw it more by looking at, say, if there was a straight string that was then bent, how, you know, the Nambu one would be much more relativistic, right, and his wasn't.
So we haven't checked that yet, but in principle we can, and it sounds like an interesting thing. Yeah, I think that would be an interesting thing, especially given that we have this expectation that the power law should become more IR dominated as you go towards the law.
And I'm correct in assuming that, like, this is a field theory simulation on a co-moving background with no sort of thought to gravitational.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of gravitational stuff, do you expect to get any primordial black holes from this? And is there a rough estimate of that for any of this process?
Why should
I get primordial black holes? So if a loop collapses to, you have a spherical loop, say it collapses to a very small thing, and the number is almost extremely small.
Yeah.
Or gravitational waves, etc.
We haven't tried to study gravitational waves.
Yeah.
In principle, people have tried to do this with numerical simulations.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't have anything intelligent to say about the black holes.
Why? I still don't understand.
No, so you have some tension in the string, right? The tension string accelerates it.
Yeah, has to be really symmetric, right? Already, know.
So, but there's many bounces, and the course of these bounces, it'll radiate away some of the asymmetry, etc. So, I don't know. It's not.
You also have some angular momentum.
Yeah, you have some angular momentum. Yeah.
So it's not. Yeah.
It's almost certainly very, very small.
Take care again.